This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross.
You think you're the first person I've dealt with woke up in bed with a dead body? Take your fingers and feel for a pulse.
Liev Schreiber knows how to handle a crisis in the new series Ray Donovan, where he plays a guy who cleans up messes for Hollywood's rich and powerful. It airs on Showtime Sunday nights. Playing the lead in a TV series is something of a new turn for Schreiber, who's been acting mostly on stage and in film for two decades. Schreiber won a Tony Award for his performance in Glengarry Glen Ross on Broadway. Among his films are Big Night, The Day Trippers, The Scream Trilogy, The Manchurian Candidate, Defiance, and X-Men Origins Wolverine. He also wrote the film adaptation for and directed Everything is Illuminated from a novel by Jonathan Safran Foer. When I spoke to Liev Schreiber, we began with the scene from his new series. Here, his character, Ray Donovan, is talking to an action movie star played by Austin Nichols. The star is in a drug rehab center, but he's being blackmailed by a transsexual prostitute named Chloe, who sent him a compromising video. Ray is there to fix the mess.
My film is opening in 3 days.
Calm down. They want money or they wouldn't have sent it. We just got away from the call.
No, we don't. I have her number.
You what?
I have her number. What? I called her sometimes. It wasn't always sex. She had a nice vibe about her.
Get her on the phone, Tommy.
Right now, don't we need to, like, call the FBI or something?
Tommy, dial the number and ask her what she wants.
Just like that?
Yeah, just like that.
Hi, Chloe, it's Tommy. Fine, how are you? Me too. What are you wearing? All right. Sorry. Chloe, what do you want? She wants $1 million. Yeah, I know, and she feels really bad.
Set up a meet.
I can't leave, I'm in rehab, remember?
For me.
And that is Austin Nichols and our guest Liev Schreiber in the Showtime series Ray Donovan. Liev Schreiber, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Good to have you. You know, when my producer Lauren Krenzel and I were looking for scenes to play in the interview, it was hard to find a lot of scenes where your character Ray Donovan says very much. Man, a few words, huh?
Yeah, that was one of the things that drew me to the character, you know. Being an actor who generally takes on sort of text-heavy stuff, I thought it was exciting and interesting to take on a character who doesn't speak very much at all.
Right. Now, he's a guy, he's in the Hollywood environment, but not from Hollywood, right? You want to just talk a little bit about his backstory and how his family, how that fits into the show?
Ray is from South Boston. And he's moved his family out to Los Angeles to work for a high-end law firm. And they represent Hollywood's elite. And what Ray's job is to sort of do the dirty work for Hollywood's rich and famous, particularly the stuff that goes outside of the boundaries of what the legal system can handle.
Right. And the Ray Donovan here, you know, doesn't just deal with, you know, extortion. He uses some muscle when he needs to. You've been around Hollywood. Have you ever met a Ray Donovan or heard of one?
I haven't ever met a Ray Donovan, but I know that they have been around for as long as Hollywood has been around. In the 40s and 50s, these guys were a lot more prevalent. But when lawyers and law firms began to really take hold of the industry in the way that they have today, the work was typically handled by them. But still, there are these jobs that need to get done that lawyers can't handle, and they go to people like Ray for. I haven't actually met a Ray myself, but typically they're sort of private investigator types or guys from the security industry.
There's an antagonism which is really at the heart of this drama, and it's your character, Ray Donovan's relationship with his father, Mickey, who as the series opens, is just getting out of prison after 20 years. He immediately goes, and this won't be a giveaway to folks who've seen the first episode, he goes and murders a priest that he believes molested his son years earlier. And then he shows up in Hollywood, and this is a problem for Ray. I thought we would listen to the first meeting between your character, Ray Donovan, and his dad, Mickey Donovan. They're in the gym where Ray's brothers are hanging out, and Mickey Donovan, played by John Voight, comes in. He speaks first. Let's listen.
Well, this is great. This is great. All my boys are together. Everyone's great.
Everyone's great, Mick. Really? Bridget's dead. Terry's shaking like a leaf, and Bunchy can't stay sober more than a month. That's your legacy, Mick.
Hey, Hollywood big shot. I want to date Cheetah Rivera, Rita Moreno, or Diane Carroll. Claudette, don't take me back. Can you hook me up? That priest, I took care of him. Some very powerful people are going to come after me now. Very powerful. Da Vinci Code type.
Only guys coming after you are the guys you ripped off. Only thing they need is the address I'm going to give them.
And that is our guest, Liev Schreiber, with John Voight in the new Showtime series, Ray Donovan. And I have a feeling there's more to unfold in the plot that will reveal some of the roots of that mutual contempt. But I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about you and John Voight. I mean, two veteran actors. I mean, I know you're seasoned pros playing parts, but when you are face-to-face, there's a lot of testosterone. These are two bulls, you know, pacing at each other. What are those scenes like?
You know, people keep asking me that, but John is such an incredibly charming guy. And, I mean, one of the things that has been really inspiring to me is the level of enthusiasm that he has for this part and the show, which I think he's amazing in. I was so shocked to see an actor of his caliber and his experience and his age be so excited to take something like this on. And I can tell you that it was not an easy show to shoot. Very intense, very dark characters. And to play them for an extended period of time is, you know, it kind of wears on you. I think there's a certain physical thing between the two of us that we match up very well. I don't feel like there's no frailty with John, so I can come at him, guns a-blazing, as it were. He's a very powerful actor, and he's a very powerful presence, and it really helps because I think he's a terrific match for Ray.
This is Fresh Air, and our guest is actor Liev Schreiber. He stars in the new Showtime series Ray Donovan. Schreiber began acting in the theater and did some memorable independent films in the 1990s. I wanted to revisit one from 1996. This is Day Trippers, written and directed by Greg Mottola, who was a friend of yours, right?
He's actually my best friend, yes.
It's the story of a woman, played by Hope Davis, and her family. She discovers a note that raises questions about whether her husband has been unfaithful. And after a lot of discussion, she and her family all pile into a station wagon and go into Manhattan to confront the husband. And so it's the story of this day trip, this family going in. You play Carl, who is the boyfriend of a sister, Parker Posey. And in this clip, we're going to hear you're on your way into Manhattan. You're all in the car. And we're going to hear Parker Posey, who speaks first. You're an aspiring intellectual and novelist. And we'll hear you and then the parents, who are played by Ann Mira and Pat McNamara. So Parker Posey speaks first. Let's listen.
Carl, tell Mom and Dad about your novel. Carl wrote a novel, everyone. It's great. It's just far out. It's brilliant.
I don't think your parents want to hear my novel.
Mom and Dad, do you want to hear about Carl's novel?
Oh, yeah. Sure, Carl.
Well, Rita, it's an allegory about spiritual survival in the contemporary world. The main character is this freak of nature. He's this man who doesn't have a normal head. He was born with a dog's head.
A dog's head?
Yeah, you know, sort of a fantastical story.
It's like a fable.
Yeah, like Master and Margarita or...
Animal Farm.
Yeah, exactly. Very Kafka-esque.
Carl, I'm not an educated woman.
It's Dr. Seuss for adults, Mom.
Oh. Oh, yeah.
So, everyone else in the book is normal, except for the man with the dog's head, who really only
what
wants...
What kind of dog?
Dad, it's not important.
No. It is important. Actually, that's very important. It's a German short-haired pointer. You see, it's actually especially important that it's a pointer, because that's a crucial metaphor, because in the book, he's sort of a visionary, you know? You know, pointing the way to salvation.
Joe loves dogs. Remember, Peppa? We had to put her to sleep.
Mother.
And that is our guest, Liev Schreiber, in an ensemble cast in the 1996 film The Day Trippers. Must be fun to hear that again, or is it?
It's really fun to hear that again. It reminds me so much of Greg Mottola. And it's, you know, it's something that we both had in common as aspiring intellectuals who love to hear ourselves speak. And also how completely uninterested our parents were.
Yeah, well, you know, we had Greg Mottola on the show, a couple of years ago, and we played that clip. And he said, you know, this was a low-budget film, even though it's an incredible cast. I mean, all those folks, including Stanley Tucci and Hope Davis and Parker Posey and you and Ann Mirren. And he said, I think he said he was crouching in the back of the station wagon with the sound guy.
I believe that there is still a shot in the film that is basically a three-shot of me and I think Parker and Hope, who are in the back seat. And at one point, you see a little bald head kind of peek up behind us, and that is Greg. Yes, he was hunched in the back of the station wagon because we didn't have any money or a follow car, and we were just sort of stealing those shots on the LIE.
How do you compare movie making in that early part of your career at that budget to what you do nowadays?
I think I was very fortunate to be working in New York during the heyday of independent film. There was just such a spirit of collaboration and inventiveness and resourcefulness, which is something that I think comes with not having a lot of money. And while some people complain a lot about, you know, where film is going nowadays, I think we're really due for another golden age. You know, when you see a 12-year-old kid download footage from his iPhone onto a laptop and then just start acting like a whiz kid with nonlinear editing, it's just, you realize that at a very early age, much younger than we were, these kids already have the tools for communicating with film. And I think that means something really special is headed our way.
We'll talk a little bit about your background. I know that your parents divorced when you were little and you grew up with your mom. An interesting life. You know, just talk a little bit about kind of what kind of life you led with her growing up.
Well, my mom was a very bohemian person. We lived in the Lower East Side of New York. She drove a taxi cab. She made puppets and sold them in the street. She later on had a health food business. And very early on in my life, infused me with a real respect and love of the arts. Her boyfriend, when I was a little kid, was a classical pianist who would perform in the streets. An insane guy, but you know, it was an eccentric and interesting place to grow up.
Right, and then she lived in communes for a period. Is that right?
I remember it's at one point my mother and I hitchhiking through the South, and I guess we were trying to get to a place called The Farm, which was Stephen Gaskin was the guy's name who was running it. And as best I can remember, the entire place smelled like soybeans, and that was the whole philosophy of that particular commune, was that you could pretty much do or make anything out of soybeans. Later on, she went to live on Satchitananda's ashram, which is where she lives now, in Buckingham County, Virginia. It was a pretty eclectic childhood.
And when did you get interested in acting?
I think I became interested in acting in earnest my last year of high school at Friends Seminary, a Quaker school in New York City on East 16th Street. They did a production of Midsummer Night's Dream, and I got to play the role of Nick Bottom, the jackass.
Uh-huh.
I was just taken with the language. I'd been studying, and I'd won a sort of citywide poetry contest when I was still at Brooklyn Tech. I don't know how authentically interested in poetry I was. I just always liked pretending, and I had this way of pretending with language, and I guess pretending with language is writing poetry. That's going to get me in a lot of trouble, that statement. But it felt like I had a flair for language and rhythm. And fortunately, I got introduced to Shakespeare early enough that I was able to kind of play some of those ideas out. And I think the first time I heard an audience laugh out loud at me, I was done. I was sold. That was, I think, my high school production of Midsummer Night's Dream.
You know, you've done a lot of narration of documentaries. I mean, you are really a go-to guy, particularly for sports stuff. I mean, I thought we would listen to a little piece of one of them that you did in the HBO series 24/7. It's a boxing piece.
There is an expectation in boxing that even the most storied, the most ferocious, the most competitive of conflicts can be settled over the course of a trilogy.
Fire against fire, down the stretch.
But for Manny Pacquiao of the Philippines and Mexico's Juan Manuel Marquez, 36 rounds over the past 8 years have not been enough. Regardless of what the scorecards have produced.
I'm calling it another draw.
To the winner, Manny Pacquiao!
That's our guest, Liev Schreiber, narrating one of his the HBO segments for 24/7. How did you get into this thing of being a narrator?
I was fortunate enough to have David Esbar from WGBH see me in a play and ask me if I would narrate a documentary that he had worked on, a wonderful documentary called The History of Rock and Roll. And I had such a positive experience doing that, I thought, this is the kind of work I would really, really love to do. And then Ross Greenberg from HBO heard me, I think, on that documentary and hired me for the HBO sports gig. To be fair, those are Aaron Cohn's words that you just heard. And I think it was a kind of confluence of events. I've always been a big John Facenda fan. I don't know if you remember who he was.
I was going to ask you about John Facenda. Folks will remember his deep intonations on NFL films.
And the NFL films guys had the very, very brilliant idea that there was a classical theater element to football. And that, you know, if they would shoot these weekly shows in this kind of epic fashion and slow motion and things like that, and then have that wonderful voice of John Facenda kind of comparing these football players to demigods and characters from mythology, it was very effective. And I know it captured my imagination as a child, so I was thrilled when I was paired with a writer as talented as Aaron Cohn who wanted to do that same kind of dramatic arc with his work.
It was interesting listening to the narration after, you know, seeing so many of your film performances. And I wondered what the approach is to getting the voice for a narration as opposed to a character in a play or a film. They do sound very different to me. I guess every character is different, but what's the approach here?
That's what people say to me. They always say, that doesn't sound like you. My own mother doesn't recognize my voice when I do a narration. I don't know why that is. I think early on in my career, when I first started going on auditions for voiceover gigs and things like that, people would say to me, you know, you sound very New York, and that's okay. And I knew what they really meant was that I sounded very Jewish. And they were like, that's okay, but it doesn't necessarily work for Peoria. Uh-huh. And I thought, oh, okay, so I have to adjust my dialect a little bit so that I don't sound like such a whiny Jewish New Yorker. And I guess that affects me in some aspect, but it's become completely unconscious at this point. You know, that's just the voice that I do. It doesn't feel artificial to me, and it doesn't feel like I'm putting anything on, but people say that.
So it's not a different voice for a boxing narration or a nature special or some other kind of documentary?
No, I think that what I'm doing is I'm just following the cues of the writer. And they are different. But I don't think I consciously affect my voice in any way to do a boxing show versus a science show versus the history of rock and roll. When it's not sports, I believe in non-invasive narration. In other words, if you can get the audience to feel like it was their idea, then you've done it. But if it's too opinionated or too arch or too emotional, I think we pick up on that and it gets in the way of us realizing our own brilliance.
I was going to ask you to give us a bit of narration for how you would describe fresh air and Terry Gross, but maybe you need brilliant writing to do that.
I think you do. You know, I'm looking at this thing in here that says how to record split track phoners in the prod rooms. And if I were reading something like that, I would just say, from the Kiatz console, select the split preset button. Press the on button on the mic 1 and PH 1 faders. Move both faders about 3/4 of the way up to zero. So I think my voice kind of naturally adjusts to how interesting what I'm reading is.
That was very moving.
Thank you. Thank you.
Liev Schreiber stars in the new Showtime series, Ray Donovan. You'll find a longer version of our conversation online at freshair.npr.org. The rapper Jay-Z has just released a new album called Magna Carta Holy Grail. He's married to singer Beyoncé, and this is his first collection since becoming a father. Rock critic Ken Tucker says the album is an uneven but intriguing collection of songs that tries to navigate a path between parenthood and an obsession with commercial success.
Knock me down. That's me in the corner. That's me in the spotlight. Losing my religion. Getting ghosts in the ghost. Can you see me? Can you see me? Have mercy on the Judas. Ain't you wings on the guinea? Secular, tell a heckler, seckle down. Yeah, religion creates division like my Maybach partition. And God is my chauffeur, boy, they love over. From the south side of Shire, Brooklyn, where I growed up. I confess, God in the flesh. Live among the serpents, turn arenas into church. I'm
like Michael Reese. Now 43 years old, Jay-Z has become the Jay Gatsby of hip-hop. A man with a checkered background playing host to endless parties celebrating excellence, the good life, and himself. It's no wonder that he was asked to oversee the music for director Baz Luhrmann's amusement park ride version of F. Scott Fitzgerald's Romantic Fantasy. Jay-Z has been popping champagne corks to his own money-making abilities for so long now, with Beyoncé by his side as a more attainable Daisy, that we're all reduced to being Nick Carraway's, looking at him with a mixture of bafflement and envy. It's a mixture Jay-Z seeks to further on his new album, Magna Carta Holy Grail, a gaudy puzzler that's both triumphant and trivial.
See what you made me do? Shout out to old Jews and old rules. New blacks with new stacks. Already been the king, retroact, I'm just bringing it back like Jordan Packs, new money, they looking down on me, blue bloods, they trying to clown on me, you can turn up your nose, high society, never gonna turn down the homie, knock, knock, I'm at your neighbor house, straight cash, I bought your neighbor out, you should come to the house for me, come and see what your new neighbor about.
That's Somewhere in America, on which Jay-Z goes over the familiar ground of the nouveau riche versus old money. Lots of black rappers chafe in their lyrics over the disdain they sense from moneyed white culture, and Jay-Z doesn't add much to this genre of resentment. The best thing about this variation on the theme is the co-production by the hip-hop artist Hit-Boy, which gives a bouncy oomph to the sluggish complaints. Its trombone brass sound effect works as a musical criticism, giving a raspberry to Jay-Z's litany. His more amusing Rich Man's Playthings catalog, a composition called Picasso Baby, finds him rhyming the Miami Festival Art Basel with Life Colossal. He praises Jeff Koons' balloons and pronounces himself rather more weirdly the new Jean-Michel Basquiat.
Oh, what a feeling! It ain't hard to tell, I'm the new Jean-Michel. Surrounded by Warhols, my whole team ball. Twin Bugattis outside the Art Basel. I just want to live life colossal. Leonardo da Vinci flows. Ricardo Tisci Givenchy clothes. See me thrown in at the Met. Voguing on these gins of champagne on my breath, yes. House like the Louvre or the Tate Modern. Cause I be going ape at the auction. Oh, what a feeling.
Despite guest cameos by Justin Timberlake and Frank Ocean, there's a lassitude to much of Magna Carta. Can it possibly be ascribed to the banality of real life? Much of this album's rhyming sounds tossed off, distracted. Is this the work of a scattered, tired new dad? That doesn't square with the high-living, self-described billionaire who's difficult to imagine losing sleep walking a squawking baby blue ivy around in the middle of the night. Or changing a diaper, although he does use Pampers as an unfortunate rhyme word with Hamptons. On the song Jay-Z Blue, he samples a bit of Faye Dunaway dialogue from the movie Mommy Dearest. But not to worry, he's not implying that the mother of his child, Beyoncé, is swinging wire hangers around the crib. On other songs, he compares Beyoncé to the Mona Lisa, and also builds a hymn to and around her, inviting his wife to join in.
I'm an outlaw, got an outlaw chick. From a Tupac on my outlaw hitch. Matching tasks, ink don't come off. Even if rings come off and things ring off. My nails get dirty, my past ain't pretty. My lady is, my Mercedes is.
Magna Carta Holy Grail arrives on the heels of Kanye West's album Yeezus, a far more abrasive production that found Jay-Z's one-time protege proclaiming himself a god and grinding the Billie Holiday classic Strange Fruit into a pulp. Jay-Z also compares himself to the deity and invokes Strange Fruit, but in a shrewder context. In the song Oceans, he locates the irony of cruising the high seas in a fancy boat while being haunted by the notion that these may be the same waters that transported slaves to America. No one is asking Jay-Z to become a morose historian, but as he's proved in the past, he's frequently at his best when he's not merely self-aware, but aware of a world that existed before his arrival, beyond money, yachts, jewelry, and boasting.
Ken Tucker reviewed Magna Carta Holy Grail, the new album from Jay-Z. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's interview with children's book author Tommy Ungerer. His books aren't as famous in America today as those of his late friend Maurice Sendak, but Sendak has said that his own most famous book, Where the Wild Things Are, was partly Ungerer, his energy, his spirit. There's a new documentary about Tommy Ungerer called Far Out Isn't Far Enough that showcases his work and features interviews with him and also with Sendak. In the film, Sendak says he's proud he and Ungerer helped to change the scene in America so that children were dealt with like the intelligent little animals we know they are. Sendak and Ungerer had the same editor who let them break some of the rules of children's books, writing stories that many adults thought were too scary or mischievous for little children. Take Ungerer's book, The Mellops Strike Oil, published in 1958. The Mellops, a family of pigs, discover oil and resourcefully tap into it, but Mrs. Mellops is nearly burned alive in an oil fire. In the early 70s, Ungerer's career in America virtually ended because he began publishing erotic S&M drawings. His children's books were banned from libraries and taken out of print, so he left for Nova Scotia and a few years later moved to Ireland, where he lives today. He's since received many honors, including the world's top honor for children's books, the Hans Christian Andersen Award.
Tommy Ungerer, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on the new movie about you. So let's start with your first children's book, which you published in 1957, The Mellops Go Flying. What were some of the worst things that happened to this family of pigs?
Well, originally when I came and met Ursula Nordstrom, which became my editor for all my first books in Harper's, I had already a book about a family of pigs. But it was quite cruel because I had dealings with a butcher who was butchering pigs and all that. But it's Ursula Nordstrom who liked the characters of the father, mother, and the four children. And she says, just do me another story with the same character. So I just sat down and did my book.
Were you surprised that many Americans thought that children's books shouldn't have anything that might scare children or upset them?
You know, that was my luck and Maurice Sendak's luck to have met Ursula Nordstrom. And she was absolutely reckless. She just didn't care about what people would say. And I must say that most of my children's books have fear elements. But I must say, too, to balance this fact, that the children in my books are never scared. You see, this is a bit autobiographical. I was brought up in a war, and I must say I've seen the war just like an infantry soldier. It lasted, the battle raged for 3 months. But I don't really remember my mother being scared. I think fear is an element which is instilled by the adults a lot of time. And I remember even in the bombings and whatever, I mean, we were always joking away. So I've always tried to put this kind of element in my picture books.
I think, you know, as adults, we try to protect children from being exposed to frightening things that they don't have to be exposed to. But for you, being a child growing up in Alsace during World War II, no one could protect you from seeing the war. It was all around you. And you went to school from about the ages 8 to 13, correct me if I'm wrong about that, under the Nazis, because the Nazis invaded where you lived and took over. So it must have been awfully hard not to be scared.
Well, you know, to be scared is one thing. Anxiety is another one. I must say we were not really scared, but there was always the anxiety of being arrested by the Gestapo, which we did, you know, once. I mean, it's... you see, if you are in a battle and you have bombs and bullets and shrapnel and everything is going up in the air, that's where you can be scared. But there's not really, it doesn't compare to the anxiety, you see, the anxiety, which is something much deeper in a way, you know, because it sticks to you all the time. Are we going to make another day? Are we going to be arrested? Is so-and-so, are we going to die? Well, dying is not so much, I mean, but still, it's all the impending menace, you know, all the time. And that's anxiety. I find anxiety worse than fear.
You were encouraged to draw during World War II when the Nazis took over Alsace, where you lived. And you were told that the Führer needed artists. Do you think that teachers were told to basically try to create a new generation of propaganda artists for Hitler?
Oh yeah, I've been totally brainwashed by the Nazis. And when you look at my children drawings, you'll find them in two categories. The ones I did at home, which were, and as I always said, you know, in my autobiography, I say, you know, I was a German in school, I was French at home, and with my friends in the streets, we were Alsatians. And I must say that my drawings were the French ones I did at home, but then at school, I had to draw propaganda pictures, you know, and that's where I learned you cannot beat a system. Really, when it's really hammering on you, you just, if they tell you to do a thing of the Führer, you draw the Führer.
Since your father died when you were young, around 3 and a half, when you started doing children's books, did you want to present death in those books? Because, you know, a lot of children lose people. They lose grandparents. Some of them lose a parent like you did. And in some countries, particularly countries at war, they lose a lot of people. So have you addressed death in your children's books? I know you certainly did a bit in your autobiography of a teddy bear.
No, not really. I have a book still which hasn't been published yet, which is about death. Maybe I should finish it. The thing is, you know, sometimes you have a book and it's nearly finished and you haven't got an ending. And the ending in my book is kind of, you know, it would be too much. but it is the story of somebody who dies, and it gets so forlorn and so bored in his grave that one night he says, "Oh, I'm fed up with it. I'm going home." And then you have this skeleton going home, you see? And his wife is there, and he snuggles into her bed, and he says, "Darling, it's me." And then, of course, he first of all, his wife is telling him to take a shower because, you know, it's still all the clay, you know. And actually, as a profession, he was a funeral director, you see, and he takes up his business again. And him being a skeleton is excellent advertising. And can you imagine the children waking up the next morning and finding their skeleton father having breakfast with them? The only problem is whenever he swallowed coffee, it went right through because he doesn't have an esophagus, so it doesn't have a stomach to digest it. And then he says, "Oh, I'm driving the children to school. I'm driving the children to school." And all that. So, but my ending was pretty bad because in my book, my ending, that's why, that's too much, you see. But I can tell you, there's a terrorist, you know, hijacking the whole class. Where the two children are, but he cannot be hit by a bullet because they go right through the bone structure, and he's able to save the situation. But that's going too far, and I'm perfectly aware of that. So I have to think of another way of doing it. But to come back to your question, no, I haven't used the death that much. No. Mm.
So let's skip ahead a little bit. We were talking about how you grew up in Alsace on the French-German border, a contested territory that went back and forth between the French and the Germans. When you were born, it was French. During World War II, the Germans invaded and took it over for several years, and that was your childhood. Then you started reading American magazines, fell in love with the America that they presented, and you decided to move to New York. You were kind of broke. I think you had $60 in your pocket. You've said you started calling the art directors of the magazines that you liked. And I think when you first got to America, the early work you did was kind of advertising, like billboards, posters.
Oh, I did a lot. I did a lot of things. As I said, it was a land of opportunity. It was really incredible how everybody was so nice. In those days, you could call any art director or editor just like this, and the secretary would give you an appointment, and you could come there and show your work. And I remember I arrived with $60 in my pocket, so I didn't have a portfolio, and I was carrying just my drawings, you know, under my arms. And one day it started raining, and I went in a pharmacy. It was on 43rd Street and Broadway. And I think the pharmacy is still there, and I asked for a box, you see, for my drawings. So they gave me a box, which created quite a sensation, because it was a whole wholesale box for condoms.
Yes, Trojan condoms is what you said in the documentary. So you're walking around with this huge box saying Trojans on it.
Yeah, with Trojan. So everybody was so nice. Not only this did they give me work, but then one art director would get on the phone and called other ones and say, "Listen, I've got this young French guy here. Why don't you come? He's got some interesting stuff and all that." And I would say, enough for success to be able to buy a house in New York 3 or 4 years later, just to give you an idea. And I'm very grateful for that. Really, New York, there's no city in my life I've ever loved as much as New York.
So you come to America, you start doing ads, and then you start doing children's books. The children's books are successful. But then you also start doing political posters. And posters for, like, I remember this ad campaign for the Village Voice, Expect the Unexpected, and you did, like, surreal illustrations to accompany that. And then you did anti-war posters. One of them is an illustration of President Johnson bending over and feeding rat poison to a dove being the symbol of peace. And the caption reads, "Peace Talks." So did people kind of connect the dots between the guy who was doing these anti-war posters and these surreal political posters with the same guy who was doing the children's books?
I don't know in the beginning, you know, because people in the children's book world are specialized in children books. People in the world of satire but I think most people realized that I had my hands in just so many elements. And then came my erotic books too, later on, my erotic satire.
Yes, I was going to ask you about that.
And so for many people, it was always a bit, I find, difficult. Because, you know, when you meet somebody, you want to pinpoint down him. You want to say, you know, like most artists carry on the same style throughout their lives. And for me, this would be just so boring. I couldn't do that. With the greatest respect. I mean, for me, every book is a challenge, and every book has to be done I have to try something new, I have to try something different, and I just have to go on. And I'm, as I said already, I'm too restless and too curious.
So you mentioned erotica. So you started doing erotica illustrations and books, including a lot of bondage poses, and then the trouble started. So, first of all, how did you, by trouble, I mean when people realized that the guy doing these great kids' books was also doing these, you know, bondage erotica illustrations, it wasn't a good thing for your kids' books. Your books were pulled from libraries. I mean, you ended up leaving
banned,
the country.
All my books, including even the children books, were banned from American libraries. And that was for me the end, and that's when I left. Because, mm-hmm. you know, I came back to Europe.
So you left America because your erotica and your political artwork basically were making you persona non grata. So you moved to Nova Scotia for a few years, and then you moved to Ireland, which is where you live now. When did you leave the United States?
In 71.
Mm-hmm.
71.
And so now that so many years have elapsed since then, and you've gone back to children's books, and those books have been published, some of those books have been published here, some of your books have been republished here in new editions. Do you meet people who grew up with your children's books and then later found out about your erotica? And if so, what's their reaction?
Well, look here, I mean, in Europe, I have absolutely no problem. I did an erotic book, which is based on the Kama Sutra, but instead of human beings, the positions are taken up by frogs, you know. And people come to me and say, you know, I was brought up with you. It's called the Kama Sutra of Frogs. And they say, you know, I was 13 years old and I saved money to buy your Kama Sutra. I had already been brought up with your books. There's no problem. You know, I've been ambassador at the European Council for Childhood and Education, and my eroticism has never bothered anyone.
In the documentary about you, you say that you still have nightmares many nights, and in those nightmares you're often being arrested, which was your big fear when you were growing up, that the Germans would arrest you or your mother.
Yeah, we were arrested once by the Gestapo, and that's in my book, and my mother was brilliant. She was a great comedian. You see, the Nazis arrived, and it was after three months, it was forbidden to speak a word of French. You could be arrested for a bonjour or just a merci. Just any word in French, you could be immediately arrested. And I had to learn German in 3 months. But my mother insisted on speaking French at home. And somebody overheard her and she was denounced. And then we had to go to the Gestapo. And before we went, she was a beautiful woman. And then, typical, you see, no fear. She took me along because she figured it's a good thing to have a young son of the Führer, you know, along. And winking her eyes, she said to me, I have to translate in French, you'll see, they are all idiots. Tu vas voir, ils se sont tous des idiots. So we were there, and my mother comes instead of the Obergruppenführer in his big office and salutes, Heil Hitler. The guy was already impressed, and then he says, well, ma'am, you know, you are in Madame Ungerer, you are in a state of immediate arrest because you've been reported speaking French. And my mother said, speaking French? Yes, we speak French, Herr Obergruppenführer, and I will keep on speaking French, and I'll tell you why. After the final victory, if nobody speaks French anymore, how is the Führer going to administrate France if we don't have any Germans speaking French? And electrified, the officer came up, came in front of my mother, gave her a hand kiss, clicked his heels, and said, at last I meet the true daughter of the Führer. Madame Ungerer, Frau Ungerer, I give you the exceptional permission to speak French with your children. That shows you that when you're clever, you can get away with it.
Tommy Ungerer is the subject of the new documentary Far Out Isn't Far Enough. You'll find a longer version of his conversation with Terry on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.